Hi, I'm Dan Messick, and you're listening to Newsroom North. This is a podcast where we're going to be chatting with local journalists and rural journalists specifically. But today, we're going to take a little dive into our first attempt at Newsroom North.
This is Newsroom North. The aim of this podcast is to connect journalists in disparate media outlets in Northern BC and compare stories, share tips, and lift the curtain for listeners who want to know more about the people making the news. Newsroom North is hosted on CICK Smithers Community Radio at 93.9 FM and found on smithersradio.com.
And of course, we have the wonderful Amanda Follett-Hosgood here, and as well our wonderful producer Pam Hassan is behind the board. We've been working on the local journalism initiative here at CICK News for quite some time, a number of years, but I'm sure many of our listeners will know that journalism in Canada, especially in rural locations, has been dwindling over the last decade, and we've seen anywhere between 2,500 to 3,000 local newspapers close up shop or be purchased by big conglomerates of some kind across Canada. So we thought we would dive into talking straight to the horse and getting the story from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
Am I the horse?
I'm one of the horses. I'm a horse. But we do a lot of the work that regular everyday citizens can't or don't. And we have the privilege to go out and speak to people and the honor of telling their stories. And so today we're going to dive into some of what we're working on. And hopefully people appreciate hearing what we have to say about what we're working on, what stories are brewing.
Yeah, so my name's Amanda Follett-Hosgood. I am the Northern BC reporter for The Tie. It's an independent online news outlet based in Vancouver. And I've been doing that for the better part of 5 years. I cover all things northern, sometimes southeastern. I have an interest in all things rural and things that impact communities outside of urban areas. So it could be resource extraction, indigenous rights, sometimes the intersection of those things. And I'm also interested in the loss of small town newspapers. I think we're becoming an endangered species. Yeah. So it's just so great to be here. And it's great to chat and talk about what we're working on and some of the challenges in the business.
You brought up a couple of things that I'm keen to touch upon. But so you've been working with the Tie for 5 years.
Yeah.
It seems like it's been longer, but you just didn't jump into this 5 years ago. Tell us a little bit more about your background and some of what you remember when you first started, because as I understand it, you were in a newsroom at one point in your career.
Yeah. So I did a journalism degree in Ottawa at Carleton. And then I moved out west to the Rocky Mountains, to Canmore, where I promptly forgot I had a degree. And I went out and had fun and learned to snowboard and rock climb. And I did that for a number of years. And then I came back to my love of telling stories and writing and realized I wanted to get into journalism. So I spent 4 years working for the Canmore Leader and the Bow Valley Craig and Canyon, which were amalgamated. They're like a shadow of their former selves. But I spent 4 years there and really came to appreciate the unique challenges of reporting in a small town. Obviously, so much of our newsrooms, so much of our media is focused on urban areas. And I think often those rural small town voices don't get heard. But after 4 years of that, I was ready to move on. I moved to Smithers in 2006. I moved towards freelance writing, mostly for magazines and some communications work. I did a little bit of teaching. And then in 2020, I think we all remember this time 5 years ago, what was going on in Northern BC. There was a big standoff between the RCMP and the Wet'suwet'en and their supporters. And I was freelancing for the Tie at that time. And I was being sent out to the Maurice Forest Service Road on a pretty regular basis. And from there, that freelance work just snowballed into a full-time job.
Yeah, very cool, Amanda. I've been reading your stuff for quite some time and seeing it in the Tie. The Tie is one of those places where you get really high-quality journalism and it's independent, and we don't really see that too often. It's funny when we often see we're all members of the CAJ, and it's funny because often when I see a lot of the awards being handed out, it's the Tie, the Narwhal, CBC, Globe and Mail, maybe Toronto Star, Canadian Press, and that's about it. And so to think about that's maybe six or seven publications, real deep journalistic media outfits in Canada of 40 million people. And it's quite dismal to see just that fact alone. Yeah. And then, of course, here in our northern communities, we have Black Press, which recently was sold last year to a big conglomerate and whatnot. But we're not seeing, especially when I first showed up here and worked for the newspaper, it's definitely a shadow of its former self. So we're not seeing the level or the depth of journalism and reporting that we once did.
I think a lot of our big national, even international stories begin in those small town council meetings or small town courtrooms where, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, there were community news reporters sitting in there picking all that stuff up. And I wonder how much gets missed these days when nobody is sitting in the town council meetings.
Yeah. Case in point, one really recently in Prince Rupert, they got slapped with a $165,000 fine for their waste management on several fronts. Something like that probably would have been picked up if there was a regular journalist going to those meetings or in the community. Of course, we do have the Northern View there, and there just isn't the amount of people to be able to be out there and pound the pavement and go cover these things. And so we're going to, with this podcast, we're going to try to alleviate that and tie some of it together. What are other journalists working on? And what is maybe even behind the scenes of what goes into reporting on these stories? Because usually what the public sees is the completed piece. Mm-hmm. And they read the piece in the newspaper or online or whatnot or hear a podcast. But there's a whole slew of work going on behind the scenes. So we're going to try to take a look behind the scenes, how these stories come together. And with that, I'll ask you, what do you got going on right now?
I've always got a long list of a wish list of what I want to tackle. I spent this week working on a story. So the backstory, this kind of stems from the pipeline, the CGL pipeline conflict that you just mentioned. It was something that happened out there several years ago, and I had later filed a Freedom of Information request about it. So I don't, in case people don't know what Freedom of Information or FOI is, you can make a formal request to any public body in BC or Canada, and they are obligated to provide any internal documents. Now, there's a long list of exemptions that they can withhold some of that information. But things like government internal emails and that kind of thing, you can request, you'll probably get something back. Good chance that a good chunk of it is redacted. So at some point, I had filed an FOI about something that happened out related to the pipeline conflict. And an internal BC government email referenced the civil disobedience work plan. And it was just this passing mention. But I Googled it because I was like, what is this that my government's working on related to civil disobedience? What are they up to? And nothing came back. No public mention of it whatsoever. So I decided, well, I'll just file another FOI, pay my $10 fee specifically for any mentions of the civil disobedience work plan. Mm. And I got 150 pages of internal government documents that they've had this plan. And this goes back to 2021. They implemented this going late 2021, shortly after the last big police action on Wet'suwet'en territory. It was also the year that Ferry Creek became the biggest act of civil disobedience in Canada. So on the heels of all of that, they were like, okay, we need a new approach to protests in the province. And we're going to begin communicating with police agencies and other ministries, specifically ministries involved in natural resource extraction, and come up with a plan here. But there was no public consultation, which just seems wild. We're talking about public protests, civil rights, but half of that response was withheld. Any potential outcomes were withheld. So I wrote a story on this is back in August, and I sent a bunch of detailed questions to BC's Public Safety Ministry and kept prodding them over the next few weeks and getting this, oh, we're working on it, we're working on it. Anyways, after 3 weeks, we published the story without any comment from the Public Safety Ministry. And I got into election stuff in October. And so once the dust had settled around the election, I sent a quick email to the Public Safety Ministry and asked, hey, whatever happened to this request that I sent you? And they were like, oh, we're in interregnum now, so you're going to have to refile your request when the government comes back together. So honestly, it felt a little cheeky to do this, but I filed a Freedom of Information request for communications about my media request. And I got back over 100 pages.
Amanda confessed to this being a cheeky move to pull because FOI requests are typically a pull for information. And during an interregnum, which is when a new or possibly returning elected official is announced, but during that time, government is suspended, meaning that current elected officials don't act like an official in their job, they act like a candidate campaigning for their job. Any journalist knows that this can be a pretty frustrating time when you want to get a quote or information from a ministry or an official, and these times of the year are just kind of cold for those type of requests. So, inadvertently, Amanda got information about her request, or rather, the dialogue around her request, which felt a little like getting to peek behind the curtain where the great and powerful Oz typically hangs out, which is something I would say is a little rare for journalists.
They actually spent 2 weeks crafting a response to me, and like within an hour of me making the request, it was in the minister's office, and his chief of staff was weighing in, and they crafted this response, and they spent all this time discussing it, and I still don't know exactly what happened. It just never made it back to me. I think a lot of people don't understand what goes into trying to get mm-hmm. this information or the stonewalling from government. Mm-hmm. I also think it's really unfortunate because I know there's a lot of people in government who do a lot of good work. And I feel like this, like when you hit a brick wall, when you're trying to get answers or accountability out of government, it really does a disservice to the people who are doing that work. So
if folks are not very familiar with FOIs, how many FOIs do you submit per month, or how often do you do this?
I make a chart. I file enough FOIs that I start a chart at the beginning of every year to track them because they're going to go overdue. You don't get a response and you have to file a complaint, and there's a whole it's keeping a bunch of balls in the air. So I would say last year I probably filed between 20 and 30 FOI requests.
Oh, wow.
So this year, I actually, when I made my 2025 chart, I put a note across the top that says, do you really need to file this FOI? Because it does, like, it's great if you get those records within a couple of months. That's how the law is set out.
Yeah.
But so often you don't, and you end up in a really lengthy tug of war with the public body trying to get those records.
Yeah.
Do you file FOIs?
I haven't in quite some time. It's funny. I get quicker responses from industry rather than mm-hmm. companies, not mm-hmm. just industry, but companies in general, rather than the government.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got sick and tired of it. And although some editors are not super pumped about not hearing back or having a comment from the gov, still try. But when there's no quick response, I just get tired of it. And we're going to move on with the story as is.
Yeah. And I sometimes wonder if readers understand when they don't see that government perspective. And I always try to make a point of saying that I've tried to get that mm-hmm. perspective from government. I think that's really important. But I still don't know if people understand that if the story appears one-sided, I would hope they would take that up with government. Like that the reporter has tried to get that perspective. And we can't just kill a story
mm-hmm.
because government or police or maybe industry doesn't want to comment on what we're working on. Our job is to hold these powerful entities to account. Mm-hmm. And it really does, in my experience, it really changes the story when government or industry is willing to have that conversation and explain, because there are multiple sides to every story.
Yeah.
But if they're not willing to take the time and explain it, it's not in there. The people who are familiar with the situation tend to see it as not being a fulsome report.
Yeah.
But obviously we only have the material that's offered to us to work with.
Yeah, that's it. And I think there's other ways to be able to report on these things and got to do our due diligence. But oftentimes we've run up against these roadblocks, especially, of course, when it's a contentious issue. And I'm also seeing it on non-contentious issues that are actually positive or should be positive for the gov, and they still don't want to comment. And whether it's they don't feel that it's warranted, or that perhaps, I know right now there's a lot of rookies, a lot of newbies that are in the cabinet in Victoria. Maybe they're just not as savvy as some others that were a little bit more seasoned. But still, I feel it's up to them to respond to the public, especially if they're getting requests from the media on a particular issue.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I know for me personally, something may appear a certain way, but if somebody says, well, actually, here's our side of it, here's the challenges we're dealing with,
mm-hmm.
it changes the whole story, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What are you working on?
Interestingly enough, I'm sure folks will be very aware. We've been hearing a lot of chatter about tariffs coming very soon to Canada. And as such, the conversation around needing to get our resources to market, to other markets, specifically Asian markets, has been coming up. And so that conversation, of course, naturally has led to a lot of the projects, pipelines in particular, that have failed in this region. At one point, there was 18 of them proposed, about 10, almost 15 years ago now, and we've seen two built, or one and a bit. And right now, we're hearing the chatter about Northern Gateway being revived, or at least Daniel Smith, Premier of Alberta, and Pierre Poilievre, leader of the opposition Conservatives in Ottawa, talking about, oh, it should be revived immediately, started construction immediately to get these resources to market. But it doesn't work that way. And so I'm digging into, where are the sentiments these days? We have seen a natural gas LNG pipeline built here across northern BC in the past 5 years. They made a very interesting distinction at the beginning of that project that it was not oil, and it came on the heels of a North Coast tanker ban, the C-48, the oil tanker moratorium that precludes any sort of large oil tanker from coming through northern waters here in British Columbia. And so now it's been 5 years since that act was put in place. It's been about 10 years or so since the Enbridge pipeline, the height of that conflict and the debate over that project. And I'm curious to know what people think now.
I have a question.
Tell me.
Did you ask Enbridge what they think?
I did. And this is the interesting piece, right? We've seen companies, at least some companies, change their tune a little bit when it comes to these issues, and especially these requests. Enbridge got back to me right away, and they were very clear that they have no plans to revive Northern Gateway, nor do they want to. Specifically, they have a lot of other capacity, as per their email to me, with other projects going on, capacity that is efficient and does not impact communities in a negative way. And so that clearly is the company saying, hey, we got a lot of other things going on that are moving forward. We're not interested in doing this again. They spent about $500 million and they didn't put a shovel in the ground. Yeah. So I think they learned from that experience. They took those funds and they invested it into LNG Canada, which is getting very near to completion. They'll be shipping LNG out very soon, in a matter of months, probably next year. And it's all gearing up right now. So they're still in the mix in this region. But it's clear that they don't want to revive this project, and probably because of a lot of what they saw happen with CGL.
Yeah, that was messy, for sure. And, you know, what I also recall is that this region was pretty roundly opposed to a bitumen pipeline. I know we talk about CGL dividing communities, and maybe it was just the circles I was surrounding myself in, but I don't remember a lot of division over Enbridge. Like, I think our elected officials were quite vocally opposed. Most First Nations were opposed, from what I remember. The community members I ever spoke to were opposed. So it was a whole other beast from Coastal GasLink.
Yeah. So I think people, and again, to that point, back 5 years ago, there were hearings that came to the region about the tanker ban. And the chief counselor for the HISLA, Crystal Smith, she spoke in favor of the North Coast tanker ban. And the reason she gave was that they are focused on LNG, but she made a distinction between LNG and oil. And that LNG, obviously, it can still have an impact, but if a pipeline were to rupture, it would explode rather than spill. And I think a lot of people who grew up here in the era of the 80s and remember Exxon Valdez, which was not that far up the coast, still remember the devastation of that situation. And oil, raw oil, just is very difficult to work with. Cleaning up, I think the world-class cleanup is about 15%. So that means that about 85% of it left in the environment is good, is a job well done. So I think a lot of people are aware of these things now, and we saw that unity. And so I think people can agree more with a gas pipeline than an oil pipeline. But again, this is what I'm wanting to look into. Have these sentiments changed on across the board? It was pretty clear at one point. There was a lot of unity, a wall of unity. all the municipalities, all the regional districts, all the First Nations all signed declarations opposing Enbridge. And so there was very few people who were sitting there advocating for that project. I think there was about 1,400 people who spoke at the joint review panel, and two of them spoke in favor of the pipeline. So it just goes to show you that was more of coming from the people. They still approved it, but it was definitely a wall of unity that we did not see with CGL.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see as we get closer to this federal election, if we do end up with a conservative government, that might change the landscape. I'd be interested in revisiting this the way you are. We also have Ellis Ross running to be MP in our riding. Now, Ellis was anti-Enbridge as the Haisla chief, I believe, but has been very vocally LNG. If he were to become our MP as a conservative, I wonder if that could change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be curious to watch how that unfolds. There's a lot of questions up in the air right now. I did interview Pierre Poilievre last year and asked him about the Northern Gateway pipeline, and he wouldn't comment on a fictitious project or a project that didn't exist. So I think they're holding their cards pretty close to their chest at the moment, waiting to see where politics in Ottawa goes. At this time of tariff talk and trade war talk and whatnot, it is true, Canada has very limited access to markets, energy markets especially. And this isn't the only place. There was Energy East, there was the Keystone XL. So all of these projects have the potential to be revived at this mm-hmm. point.
I think anything's possible.
Indeed.
It seems Indeed. Like anything's possible based on what we see in politics these days.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I was just going to say that it's just so great to talk about this stuff, because I feel like as a journalist in a rural and fairly remote area, we're a bit of a dying breed and we're all working in isolation, but working on very similar topics. And I think we have similar interests, concerns yeah. about our region. It's so great to unpack this.
It's curious because when there were newsrooms and there were journalists working together in the same place, even my short experience, these are the types of things you talk about. You'd hash out your story. You'd work a bit on it. You'd try to figure out the angles, pitch some other ideas, and you would chat with your compadres in the room to figure it out. And not just a once a week story meeting. But every day, if you came up against a roadblock, you'd be talking about these things every day. Part of what happened with a lot of what we experienced out and about was also being barred from trying to report these things. You could have help. You could have someone watching your back. Working in isolation, it doesn't often happen that way. So in the light of this podcast, we're going to try to talk to more of our breed, of our fellow journalists roaming the rural countryside in northern BC. There are still a few of us running around, and we're hoping to dive into what makes them tick, what makes us tick, and also what can we glean from some of the work that they're doing behind the scenes and what goes into this. And hopefully for ourselves as well, generate some camaraderie, but also generate some positive hopefulness that people are still out there doing work for the public good.
Yeah, and some just interest in what's happening in our region. I love talking about this stuff. Mm-hmm. I particularly love talking about it with journalists who are covering it. So it feels like maybe it'll be like an ongoing counseling session.
Nice, nice, good. Newsroom North, council sessions.